This program was first broadcast on Otago Access Radio and made with the assistance of New Zealand On Air.
Sustainable Lens, Resilience on Radio. Hear an informed, intelligent and provocative discussion of issues every week as seen through the lens of sustainability. It is brought to you by Otago Polytechnic, where all students learn how to make their industries more sustainable. It is hosted by Samuel Mann and Shane Gallagher, and joined every week by a leading figure in the sustainability scene. Sustainable Lens, Resilience on Radio, broadcast every week on Otago Access Radio, and podcast on sustainablelens.org and on oar.org.nz.
Our guests tonight are Dr. Sean Connolly, and this is his second appearance, and Dr. Douglas Hill, both of whom are with the Geography Department at Otago University, and have just given a talk entitled Community Power, Exploring the Process for Change Through the Clean Energy for Eternity Campaign in New South Wales, Australia. And the show is hosted by Professor Samuel Mann and me, Shane Gallagher. So I'm going to start off with my number of the week, which is 60, and that is the fossil fuel industry's emissions of powerful greenhouse gas are dramatically higher than previously thought, and emissions from gas, oil and coal production are 20 to 60% greater than existing estimates, and that's from methane gas. So methane makes up about 16% of the global greenhouse gases and is shorter lived than the CO2, which accounts for about three quarters, but has a much more powerful warming effect. So while bad news for efforts to tackle climate change, the new study published in Nature also found that methane emissions had fallen as a fraction of the industry's production. But of course, because it's much more increased, there's a bigger increase in overall emissions, we're still in a lot of trouble. So lead author Stefan Schweitzke of the University of Colorado and U.S. science agency NOAA said that methane from fossil fuels had played a significant role in global warming, but the gas's short-term lifespan meant acting on it now could pay quick dividends. So the good news is that reducing methane emissions will reduce climate forcing in only a few years, and it takes much longer for CO2 forcing to reduce. And since fossil fuel methane emissions are higher than previously thought, the potential to reduce climate forcing from a specific source is also greater. And experts say that study meant scientists should reconsider their climate models. So the modeling hasn't taken into account the increased amount of methane in the atmosphere. Other studies have suggested the huge growth in the US shale industry is to blame for the spike in methane emissions since the mid-noughties. But the new work found methane emissions from natural gas production had declined as a fraction of production from 8% in the mid-1980s to around 2% in the late 2000s and early 2010s. So that's my number of the week, between 20 and 60% higher methane gas emissions than was previously estimated. So, Sam, what is your thought for the week?
Thought of last week, actually. Late last week, Emeritus Professor Jeff Scott from the Western Sydney University was in town helping the Polytech celebrate its 50th birthday, which is this year. And he's had a long history in education for sustainability. And so I got to chat with him for a bit. One of the things that he talks about, he gave a keynote at a symposium that we had, he's talked about how that change is not achieved by brute logic. We might come back to that later. But one of the things that he's working on at the moment is the notion of work ready plus. What does it mean to be a new graduate? So the work ready bit's obvious, but the plus is quite interesting. The plus is talking about four things. One of those is the sustainability edge, as he describes. Another one is change implementation, and he talks about dilemmas. He's very big on the idea of having a paper in degrees called Dilemmas of Professional Practice, which looks at wicked moments in actual putting into practice what we're sort of teaching them in higher education. You know, we can teach them all the sort of the easy bits and how to behave, but what happens when it doesn't work that way? The third area is he wants people to be inventive, the third area of those pluses, and by that he means ethically entrepreneurial. And then the last one is quite an interesting one. You can see that these have all got a big sustainability bent, and that is coming to terms with people's personal values around the what he described as the sort of unstated assumptions of our modern life. So that the relationship between consumption and happiness, growth, that IT is always the answer, and that globalization is great. Now, he's not necessarily saying what they should think about those, but an important feature for people as they're heading off into their professional lives is that they know where they stand on those things.
And how are you going to integrate those thoughts? I mean, they sound like really fascinating concepts. How are you going to integrate them in some way to some of the projects you're working on?
Yeah, so we're developing a capability framework that's got quite a lot of those things in it, and the not got a name yet, but I really like the idea of calling it the Bachelor of Making a Difference, the BMAD.
That's brilliant. Okay, and on that note, we'll have a word from our sponsor.
At Otago Polytechnic, we've made a commitment to sustainability in all that we do. High quality, hands-on education is our trademark, and it's delivered with a focus on sustainable practice. We even have a school dedicated to it, our Centre for Sustainable Practice. For more information, check out our website, otagopolytechnic.ac.nz. A bright future is a sustainable future. Otago Polytechnic, proud sponsor of Sustainable Lens.
So our guests tonight are Dr. Sean Connolly and Dr. Douglas Hill. We've introduced Sean before in a previous show, which was great, and if you missed it, please check it out on our podcast site. So I'll skip straight to Doug, and he got his BA at Australian National University and his PhD at Curtin University in Perth. His research interests include South Asia, especially India, development studies, geopolitics and transboundary water resources. We'll talk to you about what that is, what they are, migrant labour, ports, labour restructuring and maritime trade, rural development, participatory governance in West Bengal, urban transformation and socio-spatial segregation in India's megacities. And both of them have just given a talk entitled Community Power, Exploring the Process for Change Through the Clean Energy for Eternity Campaign in New South Wales, Australia, which we'll talk about in detail shortly. So welcome to our show. And so, Doug, you're from Australia originally, yes?
I am, Shane. Yeah.
And where were you born?
I was born in Sydney, in St Leonard's, which is a part of the northern part of Sydney. And I lived there for only a couple of years, and then my family moved to the country. So for the majority of my childhood, I grew up in a place called Tathra, which is in the far south coast of New South Wales, about halfway between Sydney and Melbourne, a little coastal town surrounded by forests, etc.
What did you want to be when you grew up?
I think at that point, I really wanted to be a pilot, because when I was about 8, I took my first plane ride, and it really gripped me that there was this great thing that you could do. Then my dad started talking to me about being a lecturer, actually, and he was quite keen on history as a profession. And so quite early on in my life, I got this idea that this was a nice thing to do, go and work at a university. And he particularly talked up this idea of a sabbatical, which which thankfully here we still have.
So you went to school, and was it kind of the idyllic Australian childhood, wandering in the forests and on the beaches, or what was it like?
Yeah, it's relatively idyllic. I mean, I think that it's a small coastal town. A lot of people move there for lifestyle reasons. But having said that, it's also an area that I guess was fairly socially not particularly progressive at the time that I was growing up. It's an area where the dairy industry was predominant in that place. And so there's fairly entrenched attitudes, I guess, around a whole sorts of things. So relatively idealistic, but that always comes with those kind of provisos about the lived experience, what it's like to grow up in a small country town.
So obviously your father was encouraging you to do history. So what made you change direction? Was there anything particular, or was it just that you gradually kind of thought, hey, geography is kind of cool?
When I was at high school, I was really interested in the kind of political aspects. I was reasonably politically active as a high school student. And so when I went to university, I started studying politics and economics in the first instance. But the quantitative emphasis of economics completely lost me. And so I started being drawn to development-type issues. And the particular motivation for that was I had what was called a gap year in between leaving high school and going to university. And I went to Nepal and Thailand and Indonesia and really opened my eyes, quite different from small coastal Australia, you know. And that got me really fired up about development issues around the environment, etc. And gradually I shifted towards that kind of trajectory.
Right. So you did your PhD. What did you do your PhD on in Curtin? What was that?
It was a study of some villages in West Bengal, which is an eastern state of India. At the time, there had been quite a reformist-minded government in that state for the last 25 years. And so there was a lot of plaudits at that time for the capacity to be a model for the way that poverty alleviation might happen in rural development scenarios in eastern India. So I was really interested in going and exploring that. And I chose two different parts of a single district, one part of which had undergone agricultural intensification, and there was a lot of increasing livelihood options for local people, and the other, which continued to be fairly arid, and the livelihood options in that part were quite constrained. And so I was looking at the differences that these things made in terms of the capacity of these institutions, which this government had brought in, to try and initiate poverty alleviation.
Well, so you obviously have a huge focus on India, and what motivated you? What's that fascination for you? Where did that come from?
The initial moment is going to Nepal when I was 18 and being grasped by this very different kind of scenario. And then as I was an undergraduate at university, I started periodically going to India. And in between finishing my undergraduates and starting my honours, I spent a year there. And by that time, I was completely hooked. In a more general sense, I think it's just a fascinating country. There's so much diversity there. People often think about the poverty, but from somebody who teaches development studies, the really interesting thing about India is there's so many interesting solutions coming out of that country. It can really tell us a lot about the constraints of development and the kind of avenues that we're pursuing, but also the kind of solutions which we might be able to utilise and generalise in different places.
So you're interested. I was looking at the transboundary water resources and geopolitics, and is that an issue? That's probably an issue in India, is it?
It's a huge issue in India. Yeah.
And so can you talk a little bit about that? What is that?
So to frame it, I guess, and to get our geographic imaginations going, as we like to talk about it, if you think about the Tibetan Plateau, you know, and everybody has an idea about what Tibet is and what it means in terms of those broader kind of ideas about China and the West, etc. But what people don't often think about is that this is what geographers call the third pole. It's a great proportion of the world's water resources begin in that region and then flow down the mountains in the Himalayas and cross over the borders of around 11 countries. The process of it coming from the Tibetan Plateau and flowing down into the ocean, then of course it crosses national borders, provincial borders, and the way that those rivers should be utilised becomes the subject of a whole range of contestation, politics, etc. So for the last couple of years I've been, I guess about the last 10 years actually, I've been travelling to Bangladesh, to Nepal, to India. I'm involved in various groups in different parts of the world to looking at the dialogue processes by which we can think about how to manage those resources. And with a changing climate, those issues become all the more urgent.
Yeah, because I was at a talk last night with the US ambassador who came down to talk with the Fulbright forum, and we were talking about Syria. The issue of Syria came up, and of course the key driver of that conflict there was in fact a drought in the highlands, which drove the rural people down into the cities, and that sparked all the conflict. How risky is it for that region that you're looking at for conflict to start erupting around water issues, or is that something that's kind of outside? I mean, are we talking? It is quite a serious issue.
It's a very serious issue. So scholars who work on this like to throw around this truism that wars have never been started over water conflict. But the reality is that the intensification of contestation over water leads to grievances which then get translated into the conditions by which conflict can occur. So, for example, the Indus Basin, which is basically the water between India and Pakistan. Now, at the moment, there is a dispute going on between India and Pakistan, so the last couple of weeks, over some terrorist activity which has taken place on the border between those two countries, which seems to have nothing to do with water, ostensibly, except now India is threatening to renege on the treaties that it's made with Pakistan over the management of that water. Pakistan is a country of about 200 million people that is completely dependent upon just a single basin for its water, and its agricultural basis is very water intensive. And so how that water is used, it's very easy for people within Pakistan and the military in Pakistan in particular to start saying, well, this is India's fault, that why this is happening. And we see variations of this happening throughout the region. So India is worried about what China is doing on the Brahmaputra, for example. Bangladesh is worried about what India is doing above it, Nepal, etc. And then within each of those countries, there's also provincial level disputes. So it's a very, I really like looking at it because I think that it's a really interesting way of thinking about the contestation of resources.
So let's get on to your talk today, which was about this amazing project, the Energy for Eternity in Australia. And this is really interesting because, like, last week we had the Australian Prime Minister trying to blame renewable energy for some power outages, which was just kind of this crazy response to a storm which knocked over a few pylons and disrupted the electricity system. So you have this, is it our understanding that in Australia renewable energy is a point of political contestation? Would that be an accurate?
Yeah, absolutely. That's I think that what you find in Australia is a very divided polity when it comes to these issues. There's a lot of people within the society that can see that Australia is a perfect laboratory for the rollout of all sorts of renewable technologies, and that it's a place where we can really develop a whole range of industries and transform the economy in profound ways through this. On the other hand, it's also a country which has, at current estimates, about 250 years of brown coal reserves and a mining industry which is very influential in politics, a media sector that is very concentrated amongst particular groups, in particular the Murdoch press. And because of that, climate change politics and by extension renewable energy is very, very contentious and is really something which it's difficult for politicians of any shade to really get much purchase for moving things in a more progressive direction. That's not to say that there's not the initiative there or that there's not the political will, but there's a lot of pushback towards that as well. And that's one of the things that we were talking about in the talk today.
Is Australia on the edge? I'm thinking about how close they came with the 10-year drought.
Australia is definitely a place which is already feeling the effects of climate change in a pretty profound way. It's always been a country of climatic extremes. You've always had droughts and bushfires and storm events, etc. But it's clear that that is being exacerbated. And I guess most profoundly, some of the areas which are being impacted are those areas where there's a significant proportion of the population living. So, you know, it's hard to say objectively what on the edge means, but it's certainly the case that it's a country where climate change is a lived reality now.
Which I think is a really interesting dichotomy, the sort of the politics and climate denial on the one hand, but also living and experiencing the effects of climate change on almost a daily basis at the same time, which is really interesting dynamic, I think.
Presumably they're aware of that tension.
Of course. I mean, the particular movement that we were talking about today really began in 2006 at a time which is typically referred to as the climate change election. And so this took place at a period when there was a really significant drought, and it had seeped into mainstream consciousness that this was something that the government should be being proactive about. And so there was a wave of enthusiasm, I guess, at that point, which this movement, Clean Energy for Eternity, or CEFE, was able to harness to move forward and do lots of small-scale initiatives.
So what got you involved in this, studying this project? Because, you know, it's outside your research areas, and it's kind of outside where you normally work. So how did you get involved with it?
So there's two different things driving this. The first of them is that in the last couple of years I've been working on energy issues with a think tank based in Jakarta called the Economic Research Institute of ASEAN and East Asia. So we've been looking specifically at low carbon transitions. So it was kind of on my radar to start to think about these things and ask these questions. But the most significant thing is that CEFE began and really prospered in Tathra, the town that I grew up in. And so during my sabbatical, I had the opportunity to go and spend a bit of time there, and started to, the last 10 years while I've been living here in Dunedin, every time I go home I hear about what CEFE is doing and look at these great initiatives and etc. And so it just seemed like a fantastic opportunity to try and understand this movement in a more significant way. And bringing Sean in is a way of really understanding that broader application of knowledge around community movements and sustainability and how we might go about understanding those.
Is it a young people's movement?
No, absolutely not. It's predominantly so that it was started off by somebody called Dr. Matthew Knott, who's a local orthopaedic surgeon, and essentially in 2006 realised that this was a significant issue which perhaps he should be looking to try and take action on, and so organised a movement on the beach. 3,000 people turned up and spelled out Clean Energy for Eternity on the sand, Tathra having a population of about 1,500 at that point. And then thereafter got together a core group of people who formed the nucleus of the movement, most of whom, as far as I can see from my interviews, etc., are sort of middle-aged with kids, some of them artists, some of them are professionals, some of them are environmental activists. But it's been very good at including young people and other members of society. But at its focus, I think it's certainly not a young person's movement per se.
Because maybe that's one of the things that people almost be critical about Generation Zero, is that it is coming from young people. Now, they argue that that's that's their strength. You know, we are the future sort of stuff.
Yeah.
But it's kind of easy for other people to ignore them. It's just the kids. They'll stop complaining eventually. But it sounds like this is quite different.
Yeah, this is quite different. This is, and I think the way that they're trying to initiate social change is also quite different from those sort of movements that you're describing. They're self-styled, pragmatic, non-political organisation which is interested in trying to craft local solutions and bringing in the broad tent of community members into initiating local action around climate change. So it's not the usual suspects, but I think that also has its some strengths as well as its weaknesses as well.
You said initiate social change. Do they have a clear message or, in fact, idea of what that social change, what they want?
They absolutely do. They after this first moment on the beach that I just described, they then formed a community group and did an environmental audit of the district and worked out where energy was being used, both in terms of electricity but also in terms of transport, etc., and came up with a blueprint for the council called 50-50 by 2020. The idea here was to transition towards 50% usage of renewable energy and to have 50% efficiency gains in terms of the way that was being utilised. So 50-50 by 2020 became the kind of calling card of this movement as it spread from its initial moments in Tathra to become at various points as statewide, or at least having representation within different parts of the state, and actually thereafter attracting national attention.
So how big is this movement now?
Well, it's a bit hard to put your finger on, really, because one of the strengths of it really is that it's able to cooperate with local movements and mobilise them for specific events and then to move on and to do other things. So one of the things that they've been interested in doing is to try and work with community groups to get renewable energy put on public buildings, surf clubs, rural fire sheds, public halls, etc. So it brings people in, helps them to achieve these aims, and then those people may or may not be involved again. So I think that the nucleus of the movement, that the group which is actually active around these things, is probably somewhere between 10 and 15 people, but they're able to mobilise at various points hundreds and sometimes thousands of people for particular actions.
We went to Oamaru last year on the basis of the geography field trip, who went and looked at the transition town people, and we thought we'd go up and follow up on that. And it turned out it's only like 5-10 people.
Yeah.
And this does seem like a similar thing, that it's quite a small group of people making a big impact. But one of the things that the people in Oamaru said is they don't need to convince all of Oamaru. They just need to put the things and the systems in place for them to lead the better life that they want them to. Is it a similar thing here? Are they trying to change hearts and minds, or are they just trying to get it to be better somehow?
I think it's probably a little bit of both. There's certainly that... Doug's told the story of the aha moment of this Dr. Knott of sitting on the beach when it's abnormally hot, reading the weather makers, and having this sort of internal crisis of, oh my goodness, what kind of future are my kids going to live? And I need to do something. And sort of that... very much is rooted in we need to do drastic change. But I think it's interesting that there's been sort of through the interviews various people that have had that similar kind of moment, and that served as the motivation for them to actually get together and do something. But then when they actually go about mobilizing hundreds or thousands of people for events, it is much more focused on the easy access. We're making this accessible. Come out, the whole community is involved, everyone has a part to play, and so that you can bring whatever politics you want with you when you come, as long as you're there, and you know you're there for a reason, and you're going to talk to your fellow community members and have a conversation around energy and climate issues, and hopefully that will sort of build more awareness and lead to further change. But it's not directly involved in this is the kind of change we need to make, and it's not directly confrontational in that regard.
So this hopefully leading to further change, there's the sort of the crux of the question. Mm-hmm. Do we need everybody to have this aha moment, this transformation, or can we get away with just a few people having it and somehow infecting everybody else to just make the change without having that aha moment?
I think so. I think so many of us go through our lives unthinkingly, and we sort of use the infrastructure that's put in front of us. If there's a cycle path, I'll use it. If there isn't, I'll get in my car, kind of thing. And so many of us do that unthinkingly. Yes, I think it would be great if everyone had the aha moment and that led to sort of a massive transformation. But I think that point of, as long as you have key people in key roles that can make that change, I think there's very few people that I think are fundamentally against renewable energy or against taking action on climate change. They just struggle with what can I do? How can I do it? I'm already super busy. It might be inconvenient. I don't have time, that kind of thing. But if it's put in front of them, they'll embrace it. And so I think that changing hearts and minds, while it is important, I don't think it is critical.
So you said that they've been doing things like working to put solar panels or wind on the surf club. Hmm. Is that primarily to actually generate that energy, or is it more of a awareness and education tool?
It's both. It's trying to make those local clubs have renewable energy, but it's obviously also a very visible symbol of what the future might be. And I think that a really nice illustration of this is that last year, the combination of a lot of campaigning and a lot of work, etc., CIFI, in collaboration with the local council, opened the first community-owned sewerage works, solar panels sewerage work, in the shape of the word imagine. And so if you're coming along the flight path and you're looking down, you can see these solar panels that I've written imagine there. Now, if we're purely talking about the efficiency of the way that those panels should be put together, where they should be facing, etc., it's a poor use of that technology. But in terms of this, nevertheless, it's taking up about 25% of the power that's necessary to run that sewerage plant, and it's that fantastic symbolic moment where people can think about it. Imagine if the world was like this.
To what extent is energy kind of the easy problem that's we've gotten distracted by? We started talking about water, and even in New Zealand, where the it's not so intense, we don't seem to have a solution. We don't seem to be able to come up with a simple way of managing this stuff that doesn't result in the water getting polluted. And I can only imagine that it's so much worse in India and Cambodia and so on. You know, ramp it up, put those issues on steroids. What I'm asking is that the hard stuff? And is energy that we've gotten stuck on the easy stuff? But we've kind of like identified energy as the poster child for sustainability. And that's distracting us from the really hard questions.
I think part of the issue is that energy is so attractive because it lends itself well to technological change and substitution of different energy sources. Mm-hmm. And so it doesn't actually result in making us uncomfortable or thinking about how we use resources. It it's that simple solution. Oh, okay, we'll put in an energy efficient light bulb and I'll still leave it on all day when I go to work or when I'm not around because, well, I'm using less energy. That's that efficiency gains, right? That's all that matters. And so I think that does distract us from the much more important issues around how do we actually live differently? How do we have to change our behavior? How do we have those really uncomfortable conversations about, you know what, we're consuming too much. It's an issue of consumption, not about energy efficiency. And I think that's why energy is so easy to latch onto, because it fits that technological change, not a social change kind of model.
Is there a consciousness of that within the movement? Did you explore that, or was that something that ever came up?
I think that the emphasis on the movement is around everyday changes that people can make in terms of their own life, and that the simple things that they can do in order to do this. But there's also it's not at the forefront of what the movement is talking about, but certainly the people who are involved in it are very frustrated by the nature of the Australian political system and the fact that you have these large mineral companies and others which are really are very influential in terms of the agenda. So, you know, I think it's a little bit of both. It's born of a realization that there's some really complex political realities there to try and deal with, but these are the kinds of things that we can do.
Was there? Did you have a favourite moment or event that these guys did? Apart from that, obviously that big getting 3,000 people onto a beach is pretty impressive. But was there a favourite moment you thought, wow, that was something else? That was something special. Or was there something special about that you found?
I think that a moment that I really like. So if you go from Tathra, where we're talking about, and then you go towards Canberra, you go up onto a plateau which looks not dissimilar to Central Otago, I guess, and it's in a similar kind of a way. There's a great potential for wind energy there. There's a little town up there called Nimitybell, which has about, I don't know, I would say optimistically there's 500 people live there, and they're very water constrained. In the summertime, they often have to truck water in. But a few years ago, there was a proposal to try and put in a wind farm up there called Boca Rock. And you got Nimitybell School, which I don't know exactly, but I imagine has fewer than 20 kids in that school, together to form a sign which made a wind turbine. And they started campaigning on the fact that this was going to be a positive thing for their area, for their school. And you go back there now, and it's not because of those little kids that the Boca Rock Wind Farm is there, but it certainly demonstrated the community potential, or the fact that the community was really interested in embracing that technology. And so that's it's a nice moment in terms of these kinds of things. I don't know.
I think the thing that sticks out to me in sort of reading through the interview transcripts is, so they took all these pictures of these human signs that they made on the beach and made calendars out of them. And sort of someone talks about they were in the local store and the calendar was on the wall, and they said, oh yeah, I was under the E, which part of the word were you under? And so this was a point of connection and sort of building identity around sort of this is where we're from, this is who we are, and we all have this shared experience around this wonderful event of making this human sign on the beach.
And my parents are in that boat, actually. The rest of my family who lives there can point out to you where they are in that sign, and it's a nice moment.
Did you find anything surprising from your study? Was there anything that kind of suddenly, oh, I didn't expect that? Or
hmm. Not sure.
No, I mean, you don't have to have anything surprising, but...
Okay, so I've got a different question then. Can those everyday changes, can they add up? Do they add up to a socio-ecological transformation?
I think the history of social change is about those shifts, isn't it? And some of them are triggered by significant events that bring to forth people to rethink things, but often it's just a steady accretion of a particular way of approaching something which eventually wins the day. And so I think that absolutely, that the history of transformation is about those small moments building up into large transformations.
Do we know which ones work?
I think in the case of SIFI, and so there's a very specific case there, we would say that what works is building alliances with people who you wouldn't necessarily think are your allies, but who nevertheless are interested in being part of a community, who are interested in some kind of sense of collective identity and are interested in changing things for the better for their community. So shifting those kinds of people towards this kind of action is likely to be more successful, if we look at the SIFI case, than a kind of an adversarial politics which seeks to confront and speak to power head on. Having said that, I would say that we can all identify instances where it's very much that speaking truth to power moment that is absolutely necessary in order to try and force social change.
Are the people in the area, in the town that they're in, or wider, that actively think that's crazy and are actively working against it?
So in the broader region, there's a lot of sea changes and tree changes, people who have moved there in the last, say, 20 or 30 years for the lifestyle which is offered there. And so I think you've got a fairly sympathetic constituency there. But the general historical nature of the region is a very conservative one. And so, of course, when you have that situation, you have a lot of people who think that this is just troublemakers and that this is... And, you know, in Australia, there's a lot of people who think that climate change is a myth anyway. But I think in this particular case, because you've got somebody leading the movement who is an orthopaedic surgeon rather than some kind of ratbag intellectual or some kind of environmental activist, etc.
Geographer.
Yeah. there's this sort of veneer of respectability that goes with that, which I think has helped the legitimacy of the movement, you know. So, yeah, there's an interesting dynamics going on. But anywhere in Australia, you've got people who are passionately opposed to climate change and people who are rabidly trying to mitigate the worst of it. And that's not necessarily the case that either of them are particularly well-informed in taking those positions.
Do you have a go-to definition of sustainability?
Isn't this your moment?
I wouldn't call it a definition, but sort of an approach building on sort of what we've been talking about. It is fundamentally about doing something differently. Things have to change. And so, of course, we can do things differently in a regressive way, but we can also do things differently in a way that puts us more in tune with about our relationship to the environment and our relationship to each other in ways that promote well-being. And so I think that's how I would approach it.
The sample of students that you get to see is a biased subset because they've chosen geography. But are they coming through getting that?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think they are. I was really taken by the sort of the how you started off with the person from Western Sydney around how do you embed these things into education and ensure that sort of once they leave, that they're actually embracing those kind of values and those attributes and carrying it forward into their lives. And I think on the, for the most part, geography students do. It is sort of a fundamental aspect of it.
Yeah, I think that at the very least they intellectually acknowledge that there's some really serious problems with the current trajectory of the world. Now, there's obviously going to be differences in the extent to which they then embrace that and modify mm-hmm. their own behaviour and become actively involved in that. But I think most of them aspire to do something in their lives, which is going to further sustainability. And so we've got a good cohort in that sense.
So we're writing a book about these conversations. We're calling it Tomorrow's Heroes. How would you describe your superpower? What is it that you're bringing to the good fight?
My superpower?
Yeah.
My superpower is that I'm good at grasping lots of complex ideas and explaining them in a way which is accessible to people, if that's not too big a claim. And I think that that's really important because we need to be able to speak and have conversations about these things in lots of different ways to lots of different people in order to communicate these kind of issues. And so I think you need to be able to do that.
What's the biggest success you've had in the last couple of years?
I think that the work on transboundary water, I've been involved in a series of dialogues, different stakeholders in different parts of the region. Some of them have been sponsored by the Australian aid donors, but with universities in Australia, and some of them have been in European-based think tanks. And I think that that's part capacity building, part dialogue, but I think that it's really important to try and get people from around South Asia together to talk about the commonalities and differences that they have around those water issues. And so being involved in that, I can't claim any particular credit for progress, but in terms of what's been most satisfying for seeing social change, that's definitely right up there.
Do you consider yourself to be an activist?
I consider myself to be an engaged teacher. I don't think that I have the time or the energy to be an activist in the way that I would want, but I think that I'm really lucky that my job allows me to talk about a whole range of different things and go and find out about them and talk to people involved in those things and then communicate them to people here. So that's a form of activism, but it's disingenuous perhaps to say that it's activism per se.
Well, I guess, do you think that's sort of putting activism up on a pedestal makes it sort of out of reach?
Sure.
And sort of maybe we should sort of rethink sort of activism doesn't necessarily have to be this big, massive marching in the streets or doing these really, really radical things. Maybe there's all kinds of other ways of
Absolutely. I think that, there's lots of things that have changed the way that I think about the world, but one of them is about going to university. And I think that we're in a really, you know, it's a fantastic position to be in, that you can change the way that people think about the world. That's a big thing.
Should we be following Bob Hirsch's lead? Should we have Dissent 101?
I think that students are active to learn about how they can be involved in social change. And I think that when you look around the world with campuses that run courses and degrees on activism, they've been incredibly popular and incredibly... and the students that have come out of that have gained a lot from them. And I think that if we're interested in sustainability, we need to be helping our students to gain those kind of tools. So why not?
Do you think you get it past the Senate or Council or whoever it is? Why don't we ask them?
Well, I think there's FCIT.
Well, yeah. There might be something in the plan. There might be something afoot already. That's all I can say.
What motivates you?
I'm interested in stuff, and it's nice to get people to think about things in a different way.
What challenges are you looking forward to in the next couple of years?
Personally or professionally? Or
you can have both.
I think that, as somebody who works on a region which is going to be one of the largest economies in the world in the next couple of years and is already the third largest emitter of carbon, that is India, I'm concerned and optimistic and extremely pessimistic and all sorts of contradictory sentiments about the rise of that country and what it's going to mean for the globe, not for the global economy or for the lifestyles of the people in the West, but there's 1.3 billion people there, and the trajectory that it's moving on is obviously going to put further pressure on the finite resources of our globe. So that's a big challenge.
Does sustainability mean the same thing there?
I think it depends a lot on who you're talking to. I think that there's a lot of people, if you have a population where somewhere between 300 and 700 million people, depending on whose figures you believe, are really below or only just above the poverty line, then sustainability for those people is being able to live a life with dignity, which means they won't die early and see their family die early and won't irrevocably erode the resources around them. What sustainability means for a middle-class person in India that's now experiencing lifestyles that was unavailable to their parents is perhaps a whole other thing. And the challenge, I guess, is to try and cater for both of those groups of people and have inclusive growth, but do so in a way which is going to shift India towards a low-carbon economy. It's a very, very big challenge.
For those vast numbers living in abject poverty, it would be churlish of us to begrudge them a fridge.
Of course.
But can we do it?
Yeah, I think that it's going to be a long time till all of those people have fridges. But I think that this is the challenge, isn't it, to try and I'm not saying that all of the solutions are technological, but clearly we can't have the same fridges for 700 million people in India that we do elsewhere. Otherwise, the white goods industry will be happy, but it's going to be a problem. So I'm not sure what the answer to that is. I think that the rise of India as an economic force is not entirely assured either. I think that the jury is still out on that. We always think about it as, well, in the future, we're going to suddenly have 800 million people who are middle class. I'm not sure whether that's true.
Do you have any advice for our listeners?
That you should be active participants in your own life. That you should try and gain different perspectives on familiar phenomena as much as you can. And if you feel strongly about something, then you should try and take action on it. You should try and work out what kind of action that might mean for you, but you should nevertheless try and do that.
And on that note, we're going to have to finish up the show. So you're listening to Sustainable Lens on Otago Access Radio 105.4 FM. The show was recorded on the 6th of October 2016. Our guests were Dr. Sean Connolly and Dr. Doug Hill. Your host, Professor Samuel Mia, and myself, Shane Gallagher. You can get podcasts of previous shows on sustainablelens.org. We can subscribe in iTunes or on oar.org.nz. We hope you enjoyed the show.
This program was first broadcast on Otago Access Radio and made with the assistance of New Zealand On Air.